just going.
I had a, do you think we could turn this just a little to the aggressive as Mac?
Ashwin was very, very emphatic in saying that this is just a guide and we shouldn't follow the questions exactly. But I really think that if exactly the same questions are asked to everybody, it would be very useful so that you could compare. So I eventually would like to go through all the questions. I only have a time limit. I have to go to the airport at 2:30. 1:30, so let's plan for an hour. But even this being said, I would like to start with a complete different question that is not involved in this list. Half an hour ago, we looked at something that was very important. And I was wondering if from that discourse, even if you don't know exactly the discourse, from that event, from that moment that we're assisting, is there any idea there, any issue, any problem that you're dealing with as architects? Any part of that discourse has, can you name something in that discourse that is being discussed, that is informing your practice now?
I can think of one. It's the issue of agency. The sort of political message that we're hearing now is that sort of it's up to all of us to get involved, that yes we can, and that, you know, government is there and can, you know, intervene and solve problems, but ultimately people should step up to the plate. And we've been thinking very much about how in the time of crisis, and this is what Mimi and I are trying to discuss in our studio in Colombia, is, you know, what is the role of the architect? How can we continue to be necessary? This refers maybe to one of the questions coming up. Do we, are we constantly responding? Are we mediating between clients and their needs? Is there a way for us to somehow push and define the discipline without losing track of what architecture can be? Can we define new problems of intervention? We just didn't get a grant, but we tried to get a grant to do some, continue our research in bamboo, see if we could build some small schools in India. That didn't work, but we were trying to think, you know, is there a way for us to kind of be proactive and define the problem of architecture? I guess we've tried to do that in some ways, but still our opportunities have been mostly opportunistic. And when we get opportunities, we really try to bring them back to architecture because most often our opportunities are elsewhere. But so agency is maybe one thing that I can think of.
So if I pick a very specific example that you've just mentioned, you know, bamboo schools in India, how do you think you might contribute specifically as architects to that? Let me frame it this way. You have bamboo schools in India, like here. It goes back to a broader issue. Which issue is that one? And it goes forward to a very specific way of making a contribution. I mean, why a school in bamboo in India made by architects like you should be better than other ones done by other people? And so to move back to the question and move forward to the even more specific contribution.
For us, just to go back a second to Obama's speech, I would answer it in the same way that Eric just did, but one part of it really struck me, which was that when he was saying, you know, that we should be allowed to dream and plan for these visionary projects, but also kind of tailor them to what is feasible and what is necessary. So the specific grant that Eric was mentioning was a way for us to kind of take what we had kind of started with the PS1 canopy project, in that, you know, to use a very cheap material, but to contribute to the architectural profession, in that we feel that we could bring to it a certain level of design innovation and a way of pushing that material beyond the known associations of it being cheap, it being third world, it being kind of ad hoc as a design material, and to inscribe within it a more precise way of building, a more engineered way that would then contribute to the profession, in that it would be of interesting design. It would be innovative. And I forget which this era was.
No, you already answered it by saying that, you know, by the added value of working with a cheap material,
yeah.
And to make it overcome, it's kind of a natural tendency to be used because you have no other choices. It's already answering the question.
I think the contribution is the contributing to building culture rather than an object. And actually, that's something that really interests us, is to innovate new ways of building. And so in this particular case, our hope was to, in fact, learn from traditional ways of building bamboo, but then also bring some tools that maybe are not available there to hold workshops in the rethink using computers, etc., how we could push this forward and then leave something behind in terms of a way of, you know, so it would just be a prototype. Is what the hope.
Can I jump in if
yeah.
I can, and people to stop me if it breaks slow, but one of the things that I find interesting is this idea. I mean, obviously innovation is a big theme in kind of a lot of the new practices, kind of what unifies a lot of the firms that we've chosen. But this idea of contributing to the profession is something that you think consciously about, or you're more focused on sort of the results of kind of, you know, affecting the users of the schools in India, for instance. I mean, it seems like contributing to the profession is more of a side result of an interest that is wider and more general.
We do think about it. We actually propose a book again that if you all our failures. right
because there's a whole point about that.
Right after this one, we wanted to publish a book that would also be a recipe book of how to build in this way that we think we developed,
mm-hmm.
which is very simple, and just sort of put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, we're very interested in publishing our drawings wherever possible and not being secretive about anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, but maybe at the moment, the instigator, of course, is to have a one-off
mm-hmm.
result. And it's very
mm-hmm.
hard to know at that time how, you know, it becomes
mm-hmm.
systemic.
Yeah.
That is
I think another way to answer your question, I think it goes back and forth.
Yeah, sure.
In this case, because we were writing a grant proposal, we definitely were very consciously thinking about how it would contribute to the profession. I wanted to add something to my answer from before, which was that for the proposal, we had reached out to Architecture for Humanity because we wanted to partner with somebody who was who, you know, has an incredible kind of history of finding local partners and doing this kind of work. And for us, you know, we're interested in social questions, we're interested in building. Sometimes for us, a lot of socially driven projects or projects that are very much under the emphasis of sustainability fall short in terms of design for us, and kind of hide behind
moralistic,
which are great in terms of, kind of fall short of pushing design innovation. So that's why we thought, you know, it'd be interesting to for us to partner with, you know, somebody like them, because, you know, they have a whole area of expertise that we have no idea about and we really admire.
Yeah, I would say that there are several questions here that can be synthesized by asking, what is your DNA? So, like the questions like, who were your teachers? Which was your most challenging project? Which architectural projects have had an impact on you? Which books, magazines, and websites do you refer to? So I would sum maybe three or four, even five questions out of you by saying, okay, explain me your DNA. And I would like to, before all this, if you could talk about character, a figure, somebody that it inspires your practice, somebody that you really think it's cool.
At the risk of sounding evasive, so much of what we learn comes from visiting actual buildings, and this is something we do a lot. We try to do. We travel with students. We've also traveled with the Rome Prize to look at innovations in Brazil, Japan, and Morocco, and have to do with climate control. So that's been a 3-year project. So a lot of our DNA comes from. And first of all, DNA, you know, implies a kind of a fixed set of conditions that then we navigate with for the rest of our lives. And one thing we are very conscious of still is that we are young and that we are not fixed. And therefore, the great diversity in our work and the lack of fear, let's say, and just being pinned down for now. But if there is a DNA, without naming a person just now, I think is conceptual conceptually driven work. Work is not driven by tools, not by whether it's digital or whatever. Really thinking conceptually from basic principles always. Unpacking ideas of technology and program. That's one thing. And the other thing is technical innovation. And the third is trying to do public work wherever we can. It's just, even if it's a sculpture, we take it, yes, it's going to affect a few people, then we try to make it to architecture. So those three things, I think. But people, there are people that we did discuss.
I mean, it was kind of easier for us to think about buildings that really had an impact on us. And for us, the answer to that question really had to do with projects and buildings that we were always influenced by, but then the experience of it when we visited them completely transcended our experience, our expectations, the kind of all the other dimensions of it. So, discussing it. No, actually, we said Sendai and Igualada, and for us they're very related. Sendai is very much a building, and Igualada building / landscape. For us, they both are about kind of setting up an armature that is very specific, yet the experience of it is very flexible and very open to kind of evolving. So what do I mean by that? At Igualada, we were very struck by the kind of the built-in place and then the cast, the precast elements, and that this thing is kind of constantly evolving, right? It's kind of this loose armature and it's constantly getting added to layer after layer.
More and more tombs, more flowers, and more roses in the cemetery, right?
Is that after Hidalgo went there?
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing to see.
That was part of the empower. And then for us, Sendai completely transcended our expectations. I mean, you know, we were influenced by it before in terms of all the levels of technical innovation. But then visiting it, its social dimension was huge, and the way that it was being used in structured ways and very unstructured ways. You know,
like the homeless guy who
the
lived
homeless
there.
People who you know, obviously can't help there. The kind of the looseness of the public spaces, the way in which, you know, each floor was so different, but, you know, really flowed into one another.
It's something that doesn't come across in photographs or drawings, and we're really, you know, blown away. Because it surpasses this sort of stacking of different interiors. Have you visited?
No.
Sendai? I mean, one day you need to see it. Maybe it's still relevant now, for instance, maybe one point, but it seems like it's the whole city is there. I mean, because the city is kind of uninteresting, at least what we've seen. And we were driven around by one of Peter Shabba's assistants, and finally we came to Sendai at the end of the day, and it seemed like the whole city was there, in fact.
So
many things going on simultaneously. It almost sounds like the promise of Archie Brand at some level, this kind of vertical city. And the scale is manageable, and there's no beauty, and there's no kind of pretentious, you know.
Yeah. So as meta concepts, they both address something that's very interesting to us, and I wouldn't say that we've achieved it, but that we're interested in architecture, creating through architecture some sort of armature that is physical, but that, you know, the architects and the users equally, maybe not equally, in different ways have agency in how they interact with the space that they to the experience, that it is not a kind of finished product when it leaves our office. So when we think about clients or when we think about programs, we try to anticipate all the levels of formal ways that it would be programmed and also very informal ways, and also ways that it might be misused.
I won't let you go without you giving me names. So let me get back to the first question. Any figure, any first character?
Toyo Ito and Miralles, I guess, in those two buildings.
Yeah, okay. And but I didn't ask about architects. You know, I mean, you assumed I was speaking about architects. I wasn't. So just before going to the architecture, we already got that question. Is there any other?
Well, this will seem very obvious, but my father, for me, obviously, because he's a philosopher, and has always been, you know, his whole work is about going back to basic principles and you know, sort of value of knowledge, criticizing, you know, kind of pseudoscience, pseudophilosophy, all these sorts of things in order to really come up with a very basic world belief based on science. So it's a kind of a clarity that I think that me personally, I always admire in my father. It sounds very, but it's really true. So clarity is something that we both really search for, and it's not there.
And rigor.
And it's just a huge battle always to finally come up with something that can communicate in terms of our ideas and finally make those forms. So it's not about minimalism, it's not about that kind of, it's really about clarity of our purpose.
Why is that important to you? Like, why do you want to know about what figures drive them?
I think it's a kind of shortcut to understand what are you made of, who you look at.
I'm just saying, for instance, is there a connection therefore between that and, is there kind of a direct line between that and their work, what they produce?
I have no idea, and I'm just interested in trying to understand what informs and forms people. What you look at, what type of figure you follow, and then eventually it's unconscious and it's unexpected. For example, I never knew that Ayrton Senna, the Formula One driver, would have been an interesting figure for me, and I just by chance in an airport bought a biography of Ayrton Senna. It's fantastic, in its own field. I think to achieve and to arrive to a certain limit by knowing exactly how, in this case, a car was made of, and telling the mechanics that they should dismantle the engine because it didn't sound right, even though all the machines and computers showed that it was perfect. And they said, no, it doesn't sound right, for example. And they dismantled the engine and they found the problem there. So the technical approach focuses on a very specific detail that then has the consequence as making him a world champion in a very challenging discipline. And so you never know who can inform your own practice. Mm-hmm. Of course, architects are very important because they teach us in a way, but eventually figures outside the profession are as close to the way you approach problems as colleagues, let's say.
My answer is kind of very tied to now. I wouldn't say that my answer is somebody who I consciously think about all the time, but I would say Thelonious Monk, because Eric bought for me for Christmas a piano book of Thelonious' music, and it's very
similar.
Yeah, it's a piano. I'm classically trained, so jazz doesn't come easily, and it's always been my kind of secret second dream. Although it's not going to really work out because it's really hard. But it was really, really interesting to me trying to play the music, because when you listen to it, it sounds very loose. I wouldn't say very loose, but it sounds like it's kind of slipping in and out of structure. And when you look at the music and try to play the music, it's actually extremely structured every step of the way. But the way in which it's combined, that's where the structure slips, because there's kind of like subtle tweaks constantly. And so I would say the incredible discipline and the incredible rigor that you understand by looking at the music juxtaposed with the fluidity of when you listen to it has been recently really inspirational.
I have thought about this question itself. In a way, the question is coming from this sort of idea that the architect is the originator, that this kind of, that the authorship is the thing at question. And maybe one thing that ties us together as a generation, if anything, is in fact, new forms of practice that almost may be problematic, and sometimes I feel that it's problematic, but as a partnership, so few of our ideas make it past each other, because we fight through them until the best ones are also so that things become kind of more explicit, hence the term user, I think, in a way, like, sort of set of objective criteria that have informed our practice. Maybe maybe they seem objective, and perhaps underneath this there are in fact subjective forces, like my father, that I never thought I'd say this in an interview. You asked the question. But the user, I think, comes out of this idea that, like, in the 1950s in England, when the user was invented as a client that one would never meet, right, that this sort of fictitious average person for us became a way to really go beyond program, which we were very, very mistrustful of. Why should anyone really know how a building should be programmed? Maybe we sort of share with Louis Kahn this idea that the building is going to be what it is. You know, it could be something else. It could evolve into something else easily, from a church to a prison. And so the idea of the program is really a wish list that may not be the truth. And then same thing as typology. It's huge burdens we can't carry about, like, I'm designing a hospital and so on. And this is really the way we teach, and perhaps, you know, how teaching becomes so important to us as a sort of testing ground for conceptual thinking about, you know, unpacking some of these ideas. And then, and at the same time, not staying within a kind of at a conceptual level and find technical resolution. But I think the idea of authorship itself is one thing that, you know, our group, maybe we could have an interesting discussion about. Perhaps for you as a single practitioner, I could ask you also, you know, other than Senna, I mean, before you read this book, could you answer this question as easily as I did?
You mean
you're a single practitioner, what's your, you know, most important influence before Senna?
I would say my partner, who's a transport engineer.
Really?
Yeah. And maybe exactly for the opposite reasons we're talking about, because engineers do not really care about where your ideas come from and what you have to do to come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. That's a personal, private problem. Mm-hmm. What I need to do is to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. Your problem is how much things you consume to be able to give an answer. And I think that's so healthy. And what I'm trying to combine, in a way, I guess, in this interview, that I started with a question that is outside discipline. It's a question that is applicable to any citizen. So it's a horizontal question, let's say. But I would like to understand, after this hour of conversation, how your own specific formation and the books you look at, the practices that interest you, connect with a non-specific issue. That's what I'm trying to do, you know, starting from very different far away points, in the sense that when it's very specific, it's very private, it's about the author. The other one, it's a complete non-personal thing, and somewhere in the middle, architecture appears. And so that's what I would like. I might go in and out of this personal approach, trying to understand who you are, and then trying to talk about issues that are not even architectural. So let me spend still a little bit of talking about what's your DNA, what books, magazines, websites you look at. And I would say, again, without taking the names, mm-hmm. why?
I can give you that.
What are you looking at in those books, magazines?
Okay. I think there's several degrees of looking. One is the very superficial, you know, the kind of barrage of email format, online stuff, where, of course, you know, we look at current contemporary projects. This is kind of peripheral. I don't remember what I see.
At that level, what are you looking for?
News, in a way. It's just context. It's just not
forward.
Zakir's devouring of images. It doesn't necessarily have a purpose. It's pleasurable.
I say images, but I'd also say, like, who the clients are, who is building, who's being put together with whom, client with architect, or in terms of architects and their consortiums, who's working with whom, the kind of like political context that are underneath the project. In terms of what we look at more regularly and return to, I would say thematic magazines, and the only one that the two of us could come up with was Detail.
Detail, yeah. I mean, that we use in the office, let's say, as an actual resource. You know, we like magazines that have drawings, very explicit technical drawings. That's what we really are interested in, ultimately.
Yeah.
Or visiting buildings. So the images, you know, we always look at only once at these magazines that we get at the office. I won't name any particular names, but we have them for the, you know, for the office.
It's there for the month, but then they don't get returned, too. So...
Well, for me, the Oeuvre Complète, like if there's like one kind of set of books, I mean, that's always there next to our dining room table. We have a lot of books at home. It's something we, you know, love and look at and collect. And then, but, you know, this is one returns to.
Yeah, and then Adrian Forti's book, Words and Meanings.
Words and Buildings.
Words and Buildings, sorry. We find we return to quite often when we teach and also when we... prepare to give talks about our work, like just going back to basics of, you know, architectural terminology, because we want to be careful and kind of understand the context of architectural terminology and make sense to people other than architects. It's important to us. So,
he already unpacks the introduction of words that's program, for example, into modern architectural language, circulation, so on, and finds the origin, when did it get introduced, most of them in the 20th century, things that we take for granted, and what are they really, their analogies. They're not, I mean, we're not very precise as architects, we're very unscientific in our use of language, and, you know, it's all stuff, you know, behind even such simple words, so we try to go back to basic principles, looking at that text.
Okay, let me now try to go through the questions as they are, so that then can be comparable to others. If others decide to do the same thing, which I would strongly recommend that they encourage to do.
Well,
the
next, though.
Okay. Do you consider yourself part of a new generation? How does your work relate or radically differ from the other 10 friends in this issue of praxis?
Well, I could say that, first of all, these 11 firms are inherently heterogeneous, pragmatic, and yet we're all the same age, roughly. And I think it's maybe just a mirror of a larger generation and, you know, context. So it's hard, therefore, to feel part of the generation when the generation itself is so diverse. But at the same time, we do, you know, we do look at the work of our colleagues, and there's a kind of a dialogue. And so perhaps the people closest to us who happen to be in New York, you know, are kind of our, we see as our peers. But again, I think that this idea of actually visiting buildings and, you know, being more influenced by that than even our generation is kind of what we discussed, is important to us.
I think something that ties us together as a generation, but again, it's a heterogeneous thing, is that I think that one consistent thread is that we're all trying to ask larger questions that are perhaps sometimes outside of architecture, but then can be brought back into architecture and kind of build on the profession so that it's not only answering to itself.
Do you think this is something that distinguishes this generation from others?
Perhaps,
this one?
Perhaps, I mean, maybe it maps or mirrors economic cycles, and we're going to maybe find out very soon whether the
next generation. Well, you don't have to have that question.
Well, I mean, the architecture of the late 70s and early 80s, you know, where it's coming in terms of architectural history is important, but it's also important to look at the fact that they didn't have work. And so that, you know, there's a kind of interesting representation and, in, you know, theoretical work at this point. Maybe our generation has been formed differently because of our opportunities, but or maybe something philosophical as a reaction against that previous generation. But we do try to get stuff done, and I think they were interested in a very sort of pragmatic approach.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say that it's entirely new. I mean, because of the studio that we're teaching at Columbia, we're looking at visionary projects from the 60s right now. I would say that, you know, a lot of those visionary projects were trying to push against how cities were being built and the kind of, you know, top-down agencies of how they were built, and trying to argue for more responsibilities for the architect. And in some ways, I feel like we're, you know, in a similar time.
Do you consider your firm's work to be digitally driven?
No.
No.
We use it as a means to an end.
If anything, we try to consider our work to be conceptually driven, and we actually are very critical of the elevation of the tool in maybe our recent work to the driver's seat, in a sense, and we see it as a kind of a fantastic aestheticism, largely, but not completely. So many of our works have in many of our projects, the digital is very important, but invisible. So, for example, PS1 is made of bamboo, impossible without a computer. Same with Windshape, made of string. You know, we had a laptop on site, you know, but it's not our interest to necessarily leave this trace. Mm-hmm.
We actually purposely tried to erase the trace. We were just speaking informally about PS1 before you got here. The most, you know, inspiring moments were when we had to change it, because we realized on site that, you know, certain things were not working, or that, you know, the kind of tensions of the bamboo and the shapes that it was producing was more interesting than the shapes that we were completely controlling in a digital process.
Another example is our Ordos project, where we use parametric modeling to superpose three floors and yet only have four columns and then a perimeter wall. And to actually have everything work so this is parallel, we went through many iterations and would not have been able to do this without parametric modeling.
But we don't
talk about it. No, it's a tool, and it's an indispensable one. So SolidWorks, you know, something we're using in the studio to try to look at parametric relationships, but it's not part of the discourse.
Okay. So let's jump back to the non-specific, to the air out there. How can we ensure that architects continue to be necessary during crisis? This is a mental or economical one. What role, if any, did the profession play in the current housing crisis? How do we continue to be productive without escaping into paper architectural theory, or without completely abdicating responsibility for landscape mediation of the planning?
Well, this is a question that I contributed to. I don't know the answer personally, but we thought this would be an interesting question for all the other architects. Because there's an incredible fear that right now architects have no work, but not just that, but people don't need us, really. And there's enough office space, there's enough housing, we can just renovate and so on. And there's a fear also that we'll escape into other professions. We have great talents that can be applied elsewhere, and we've seen this with our students and our peers who, you know, could be really good at the internet or, you know, website design or whatever, and they become website designers, or worse. But is there a way, without losing the architecture profession, to insert ourselves into processes that are still necessary, or to find different ways of thinking? And it's a question that we have no answer to. We almost thought of teaching our entire studio about that, or hosting a competition to see what people come up with. So, for example, we still need to build roads. You know, can we insert ourselves into that and bring a kind of other dimension to the highway infrastructure throughout the United States? Or is, you know, all these empty factories the way that Buckminster Fuller wanted to retool, and is there a way to get them to do something else, you know? Or is a way for us to expand our domain without losing the disciplinary definitions, which are very important in architecture to maintain, you know, ultimately. We're here to design and mediate the larger problems of the planet and, you know, create spaces, and not just waste our talent on ornament or on it. Virtual realms, really. So we feel that strongly. So I don't know the answer to turn out there.
Can we keep on bringing into that example of highways? I think it's a very interesting example, and actually it's a very recent thing for me as well. You know, being my partner in Elemental, a transport engineer, so highways is something natural for him, at least, to try to do. I mean, let's try to do a highway and apply to funds and look for investors and everything. And not long ago, he having a conversation with another engineer, supposedly having to have a role into doing things better. This other engineer, young as well, said, you know what, but in this project we're doing, it's a private concession. We're not calling any architect. I mean, we don't make this thing, this highway, become more expensive. It was very brutal, and in the sense that architects, you know, okay, if we've got money, we're going to call the architect, and the assumption is that the architect is going to make it look better, maybe, but not necessarily be better as a highway. So, even though you clearly say that you don't have an answer, do you have any clue If an engineer like that one says, you know what, I'm doing a highway, but I'm not calling you architects because I don't want it to become more expensive. How do you deal with such a...
Maybe one way to deal with it would be to try to... This answer is the more expensive answer, but to try to do more than one thing with the highway. So rather than the highway only solving the necessity for X amount of more road, what if you combine that with harnessing energy in some way, like asphalt, the surface of the asphalt, or in some aspect, right, that you combine or you kind of multiply the roles of things. And as architects, perhaps, you know, we are good orchestrators of pulling together disciplines, and perhaps that's where we, you know, can put design innovation. So not in making forms more expensive or processes more expensive, but reprogramming things.
Respond to any of the following pairs of terms, practice versus pedagogy.
Yeah.
Any of the following terms?
It's practice with any of those. Let's start with the last one.
Which is
build versus unbuilt.
Okay.
We're not interested in anything that we think might be unbuilt. So we try to get as much built as possible. In fact, I'm responding to this because the last two lectures we gave were titled 63% built, 37% not built, which was us kind of taking a snapshot of where we were as a firm after 9 years, you know, like the projects that we actually designed, which ones actually got built. So we feel clear of speculative ideas kind of projects, but it also, you know, we try to take on, for example, we take on things that are not necessarily architectural, like installations or landscape type projects, but we try to kind of incorporate other disciplinary thinking through architecture. I don't know. Practice versus pedagogy?
Oh, well, the order doesn't matter. I think it's a provoking pairs history versus theory, or book versus block.
Can I combine this with another question, which I thought was interesting, about research, unless you wanted to make a specific question out of that? Because research and practice, maybe, is another pairing.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. It's such a strange thing for us to think of research as something separate from practice, and I don't think our generation is, you know, particularly the first one to do this, but I think research is such an inherent part of architecture to begin with, unless we're copying patterns and templates like in the 19th century. I mean, I think at every level architects are researching. So the question of research becoming sort of independent form of practice outside of even practice, it's almost an contradiction in terms, but it's still kind of interesting to us. So we were trying to do a little bit with our own press research, going to these different countries and trying to cut a cross-section across different cultures and different histories, looking at traditional architecture in Morocco versus 1960s architecture in Brazil versus something contemporary in Japan, to see commonalities in terms of strategies at various levels, dealing with climate and things like that. So in a way that hasn't translated into practice, but the objective, as Mimi says in the end, is to somehow assimilate some of this information and, you know, and learn from it and apply it. So maybe it's the difference between applied research and sort of basic research.
Why do you think research is so important? I was yesterday in a conversation and Eames was quoted that he said, "I only invent when I have to."
That's great. But he's probably lying. Because, I mean, at every point we're asking such basic questions, always the same questions again. I mean, as if we've never been able to copy ourselves successfully. I mean, you know, one would hope that we just pull out a project that hasn't been built, but we can't even do that. I mean, we're always asking the same questions over again. Isn't that research? I mean, nothing's taken for granted.
And
Why do you think it's that?
It's
something coming from schools that you're a bad student if you're not creative or if you just copy. But this is exactly the opposite from a businessman. I mean, if I have to invest time, energy, and resources in research all the time for the new thing, I mean, when does the right moment where once I discovered something, I just apply it and make money and have a better life and have more time?
We're very inefficient, so I want to answer that.
I think part of, maybe this is a really loose definition of research, but part of it for us is trying to tailor our ambition of each project correctly so that we're not, inventing, but that we understand the limits of each project and that we understand which one of those limits could lead to something productive. So for us, it's about understanding a question and for us to ask the right question of each scenario.
It's very bracketed, it's true. I mean, to unsay a little bit of what I just said, in a way we are efficient as well because we do very quickly establish what those limits are in each project. So there's a kind of already a box or an understanding of a set of limits that maybe being partners need to become explicitly foregrounded very, very early.
It's a very interesting question because I was at a symposium a new practice similar to yours is presenting, and a practice that's interested in a lot of kind of wider definition of architecture. It's a very similar idea of kind of how you go about approaching a project. Somebody asks, I don't understand why you're doing this. Why don't you just do what you were trained to do as an architect? Well, what are we trained to do as architects? I mean, I don't think there is an idea of I think it is opposed to this idea of kind of take this from the book and apply it. Right? I mean, I think it's completely... I mean, maybe it was like that 100 years ago, but probably not.
I'm personally very jealous of practices that are able to push a certain strain of thought. And the ones that I'm thinking of, do it not in a kind of dumb, rubber-stamping way, but, slightly...
Like jesting.
Shigeru Ban, for example. Mm-hmm. I think he's been incredibly inventive and consistent, yet he's kind of constantly evolving this, depending on the scale of the project, from small shelters to stadiums, mm-hmm. but, the approach is really similar, and perhaps the technology is also similar. I'm really jealous of that. We haven't, found the right, I don't know what it is, approach or formula or a combination of clients and response. But, not that I think it's the only way of practicing, but I guess, we were, revisiting the bamboo project for that grant specifically to try to, we felt like, all right, it's 5 years since the beginning.
Yes, one.
In the beginning, we were very nervous about being billed as bamboo architects, but we felt like, let's try to push this, not as a one-off piece, but as a way of building that could merge our interests, but could be, doesn't necessarily have to be bound to us as office, that we would be able to find a client or a local agency and leave them the template.
I agree. If any company, not just an architectural firm, wants to make research and development, it has to come to the board and the board has to approve funds for doing that.
Ours has turned 18 months last week. Yeah, we have a 3 months baby and then 2 year old girl, and then there's older son.
Thank you. You look very well rested. Maybe it's because you're traveling.
This is my first travel actually after this 3 months. So no, I was saying that when a company has to decide to make research and development, it's a huge amount of resources that have to be invested actually. So it's not that the company decides that to do that often, or it has to be very strategic. Otherwise, you can't survive. So from that point of view, I would say that innovation comes because there is a new question, not because there is a new answer. If the question is new, of course the available tools, the existing tools, the existing strategies are not enough because the question is new. So, as a consequence, what you get is a new answer, and what you see is a new thing, something fresh, something original. But let me finish this idea. I would say that if that is going to happen, and that tends to happen in every single project we architects do, then we should get paid for that. And there, I think, is the problem. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a problem that we're always trying, because any project, in a way, it's a new project, that we're always trying to do research, to come up with something new, or trying to understand if there's a new question within what we're being asked. The thing is that if we get paid for that, fine. And to be paid for that, I think we have to be very clear to explain what does everybody gain by doing things this way. And I think there is a problem. Normally, we architects can't explain what is the gain for the client, for the users, for society, for ourselves, in doing things differently, in doing things in a new way. And normally we have to build up a name, so the only gain by doing it new is that by being original, you have kind of aura around you that you're creative, so you're becoming a brand, you're expensive, so it makes business in the end because of the aura of the authorship, of the unique piece. But I think that can happen very rarely, and we as a profession have to be able to explain systematically what does everybody gain if we do it something differently.
I think there's three things I want to say about that. I think, first of all, architecture is very different from other business models in that we don't have serial production. You know, we don't have the luxury of being able to test our research very quickly.
Well, not really. I mean, the city is done 90% out of serial production.
Well, I mean, as a kind of a body of work of architects, we are able, in fact, to create serial production. And maybe that's why we need to push research, not necessarily in every project. But it's very very different than, say, a company who's going to invest in R&D, perfect a technique, and then produce. I think in the larger picture of our work, the temporal aspect is very different. The second one is, who is asking the question? Who is asking the new question? What if the question is incorrectly framed? What if there is a real question behind the facade of an apparently normative set of conditions? And this is what we're interested in. And so inserting ourselves into that process is maybe a limited way to create research or to bring research into work. It's not so much about constant reinvention as it is about trying to go back to basic principles and ask the right question.
I agree with that. That's very important. And let's agree that we're trying to answer the right question.
Right.
And
we always feel that, you know, we're being asked the wrong question. The third thing I wanted to say.
Sorry to interrupt.
No. Okay. Welcome back.
Okay. We're on the last question.
Editing will take care of these questions.
I'm sure we'll add that back in. Only two things I want to say.
Okay. Referring actually to something Irina said, or maybe you also did say before, I mean, are we constantly trying to ask this question because that's the way we're trained in school? Is it in fact a question of formation, or is it a larger disciplinary question? Like, what's the purpose of an architect? Is it just to carry out a given body of knowledge that is relatively static, that only needs to move forward at critical moments in history to respond to changes, or is it just the nature of the profession? So you were saying before, well, the architect is expanding the discipline, something that we're actually kind of against in a way, because if anything, how can we just bring stuff into the discipline is what we're trying to always do. But we do have certain skills that are portable, clearly, and this is the danger and the blessing of being an architect. We're trained to think strategically. We were great orchestrators, as Mimi says. You know,
strategists.
Yeah, and we have to take tools that can be applied to anything in the built realm. Mm-hmm. But then what defines our discipline is our purpose a little bit more. Mm-hmm. We have techniques that we are able to then, you know, at least craft our purpose and therefore our scope and choose the right projects or, you know, innovate in the right
One of the things that I was thinking when you were mentioning the highway example, I was going to ask you what country that's in.
What?
The highway example of the person who said, well, I'm not going to bring the architect. Because I think also what's true is that the role of the architect, definitely in this country, probably also in, you know, Latin America to a certain extent, is very different than, for instance, the role of the architect in Europe, or at least, you know, I think there's, and perhaps that ties into kind of Obama being inaugurated and the fact that there is perhaps an opportunity to, hopefully, to kind of reinsert ourselves and regain some sort of the idea that the architect can do more, you know, this kind of social status, which is indicative of kind of being able to do things for others in a way that's much more expanded in a way. Which is not much about making things expensive, but it's about being, you know, kind of like a doctor, you know, being somebody who's part of society in a different way, which I think, you know, certainly I found that in Europe it's very different. You know, people refer to you as, you know, the architect in a way that has a very different thing than here.
In Europe? You mean?
In Europe.
In Argentina, when you graduate, they give you the keys to the taxi. The architect.
This is your father coming back.
No, we go right here. I always think about
the reception that we got at Archibald. We went in 2002, Archibald. The Minister of Culture showed up. There were signs everywhere in this town. And there was a huge showing. It was a cultural event. It had value. It had interest beyond just, you know, singing to the choir. And we were amazed. We were amazed at how broad the reach of what we thought was a pretty marginal group of youngish architects could
But it is marginal in the end. I mean, the minister that came was the culture, which doesn't count. I mean, who cares about culture? I mean, if the economy minister would have been gone, then I would have thought it was a serious thing. I mean,
but still, I mean, yes, it's something that has to do with culture, has to do with kind of the social, the culture, and then there's also kind of a more social responsibility. But I think
culture is not really important.
We already are. I mean, that's a question. How can we go beyond culture and become?
Or how can we translate into something else? Right? Yeah. How can it be something?
But this maybe does, to some extent, qualify our generation, at least on paper. I mean, a lot of the people we know are, you know, genuinely interested in, you know, not just responding to clients, especially in New York. I mean, most of our friends have retail projects or high-end residential, something that we've consciously, you know, not pursued. Right now we're working with the City of New York on a health clinic in East New York. It's one of the design for excellence programs, which we took on for social reasons. We wanted to try this. We don't have any experience doing a health clinic. We wanted to try doing this. But also because we want to create things for the general public. And I think the generation that is included in this list largely shares this too. If you look at their work, they're not, you know, they're not going to be talking about the high-end residential projects. Most people here are earning their bread and butter on. Maybe it's just being unlucky, we don't know any rich people, but I think there's not a sea change, at least to kind of something different than from what I remember in, you know, undergrad in school. In the late 80s. Yeah. Anyways.
Okay. At least we went more or less to questions in there.
This is the way that I'm doing it.